What's up, Dune fans? Welcome back to the Do Not Enter podcast, where today the cruelty of the universe is brought by the storms of spice. I'm your host, Humphrey Hsu, and joining me are my friends and co-hosts, Fillmore John.
What's up, guys?
And Nolan Zhang.
Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back, everyone. And today we will be covering the first half, not the first half, the full chapter of chapter 46. Wow. So we've been splitting chapters so much that I'm getting used to saying first half, but it's the full, actually the full chapter 46. It starts off kind of slow. Yeah, it's quite the exciting chapter. It starts off kind of slow, but it builds towards quite the climax. So so it should be really fun to discuss this. But before we start discussing everything, how have y'all's weeks been? Anything new to update us on?
I finally got my license.
Hey, let's go. My man's on the roads.
Yep.
He's gonna be driving everywhere now.
Yeah, it was kind of scuff, but fortunately I passed.
That's all that matters.
You're gonna be our private chauffeur, you know.
Pay me $100,000 a year.
Hey, well, I don't got that kind of money. How about maybe like 100 cents a year?
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's fine too.
Yeah.
Like inflation goes crazy anyway.
For real. Yeah, in a year, $100,000 will be worth 100 cents. So. But honestly, that's really exciting. License is always a great, kind of a great milestone to have.
Yeah. Yep.
Very exciting. How was your week, Nolan? Anything fun?
Really tiring, but I got paid for my first couple hours yesterday at my job, so wow. I'm just like trying things out.
Nice. Yeah. So do you get paid? Let's start. Do you get paid weekly or?
I think I get paid bi-weekly.
Oh, that's pretty nice.
Yeah. I get paid every 2 weeks.
Yeah, I remember at my other job, I got paid every month, so it's like a little slow, but I still got all the money, so that's okay.
How long are your shifts at your job?
Mine was just coaching a summer camp, so it was just 3-hour shifts, but I didn't go, I sometimes only go 2 or 3 times a week, so.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so it's
not. How long are yours, Nolan?
Mine's usually like 2 hours during a school day, but then on like the weekends, it could go to like 4 or 5 hours.
Ooh. Oh, okay. So are you planning to work on the weekdays?
On the summer, it'll be different because they'll be having summer camps, which is like full day. It's like 9 to 3, I think, or 9 to 4. Wow. Yeah, I do plan on working all that time because like I want the money.
That's a lot of money to be made. That's 35 hours a week, almost full time,
that's
at least it's not like physically exhausting.
Yeah, it's quite a chunk of change. Yeah, cool stuff. All right, really exciting week. Nolan, why don't you take it away with the epigraph?
Okay, so today's epigraph reads, "And that day dawned when Arrakis lay at the hub of the universe with the wheel poised to spin from Arrakis awakening by the Princess Irulan." So it is strange though, because like today the epigraph's description of Arrakis really reminded me of how people describe, in a way, like ancient Egypt at like the center of the known universe, at the center of the world. But the thing is, like, for me, the biggest difference between Egypt and Arrakis is just the fact that Egypt was like a center of commerce and economic trade, where all the goods came and went, right? It passed through there. On the other hand though, Arrakis also is kind of like the center of the world, not quite because of the trade that goes through, but rather because of the universe dependence on the spice that's produced on Arrakis. And now the wheel is poised to spin because it's like the beginning of a new era, right? Like the start of a revolution that like redefined the entire universe. So overall, I really just like, I enjoyed the epigraph's like ability to evoke in my head, at least, an image of like ancient times and like ancient technology, and just like a desert scene.
And it's so short, and you can really feel the exigence of this chapter in this just one sentence, really. It's just on the tipping point, right? You never know which way the knife will fall, and that's kind of the beauty of this chapter.
Sort of like gambling.
I guess, if you want to put it that way. Not that we endorse gambling, but
I mean, unless you're in Vegas.
Oh yeah, well, you kind of have to do it if you're in Vegas, but make sure to walk into the casino don't have your credit card, don't have your wallet, just take
responsible with your money.
Don't make your family sad.
Don't make you sad, that's the important thing.
Unless you win it all, which is Very low chance.
You never win with the casinos. Yeah. Anyways. Yep. Cool. So really cool epigraph. Thank you for that, Nolan. And before we get started, let's do our quotes. So Fillmore, as usual, you have the first quote.
Okay. My quote this week is, one said, a great, great, great grandmother of a storm, Muad'Dib.
Wow. Great, 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 great. You know, how many greats are there? Yeah.
Times infinity. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is quite the great storm. My quote goes, use of atomics against humans shall be cause for planetary obliteration.
I wonder where we heard that before.
Death Star moment.
Oh, I haven't. Oh, okay. I'm not familiar with Star Wars as much, so.
Was it the Death Star that where they used an atomic? Didn't they just like blow it up?
I know, but like the Death Star was used to like makes like people fear like planetary obliteration by the Empire.
Oh right, because the Death Star could one shot like planets and stuff.
Yeah,
right?
Like, boom.
Funny. Yeah.
Okay, my quote is: "You see, gentlemen, they have something to die for. They have discovered their people, their awakening."
Ooh. Yeah, the Great Awakening, Part Two.
I wake up too, but okay.
Probably the Great Awakening.
Isn't the Great Awakening something else?
Yeah, it is. Yeah,
it's the religious.
Yeah,
awakening.
The religious upheaval. Yeah. Well, you know. Well, this is religious too, in a different way. You know.
I mean, true enough.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So there are some parallels there. Cool. Yeah. So cool quotes, and let's dive right into the chapter then.
Okay, so we begin the chapter with quite the sight. So Paul and Stilgar are spying on a starship lighter where the Sardaukar and even the Emperor are residing in. Wow. And they mean business too, because they brought 5 legions of Sardaukar, or around 25,000 troops.
Wow, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the chapter really just starts off with some beautiful imagery that I shall read to y'all because I really liked it. So it goes, the oil lens was focused on the starship lighter exposed by dawn in the basin below them. The tall eastern face of the ship glistened in the flat light of the sun, but the shadow side still showed yellow portholes from glow globes of the night. Beyond the ship, the city of Arakeen lay cold and gleaming in the light of northern sun. So this is like this beautiful description of like the scenery, just like perfectly set up this entire chapter. Just like this kind of like the calm before the storm almost. Like this scene, the setting of the scenery kind of reminds me of like in the Lion King almost, where Mufasa takes Simba up to like the mountain and it goes peers down on his like on the savannah as the sun rises and goes like, everything the light touches is our kingdom, but a king's time as ruler rises and falls like the sun. One day the sun will set on my time here, but you will rise and will rise with you as a new king. Basically it's just like it's just like a time, like it's just a time of renewing, right? Like just the same moment here with like Paul looking down on the Harkonnen, Eric King and everything, ready to claim his kingdom almost. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, what a cool scene to reference, even though I haven't actually seen The Lion King, so please don't kill
what?
Me.
What?
Yeah, I'm not a big Disney person. I don't think I've seen really any of the... I don't even remember seeing Mulan or anything.
Dang. So I watched Lion King at Broadway, so I have lots of experience with that.
Wow, that must have been quite the experience. I love seeing shows.
Really fun.
I love seeing things in person, like in the real life. It's so much better than through technology, even though it's convenient, you know.
Yeah.
Especially for me, that goes true, holds true with music concerts and stuff. But yeah. So, but I mean, but my point was that the vivid imagery of this cold dawn, it's just really chilling, and it just makes sense that it's chilling because it's the first time we're laying eyes on Arakeen in maybe 300 pages or so, right? We haven't actually come back to this place in forever, and it's a return to where the Atreides fell. So you can kind of feel the ghostly kind of vibe that you're getting here, right? Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely come full circle. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we're kind basically. Of a big battle the last time we saw Arakeen, and now we're here and there's another big battle, so yeah.
Some of those traumas that you have to overcome before you move on in your life.
Yep. But also, how long was this time skip? Because like, was it said before that the Emperor's like here on Arrakis? Or I mean, I think it was mentioned that he was like hovering above and now he's just, you know, now he's just on the ground, so there must have been like at least some time skip, right? And I mean, what I think is crazy is how the Padishah Emperor, you know, I expect him to be chilling on his throne, eating sweets, kind of thing, and watching TV, right? But instead, he's come all the way just to see the Fremen destroyed, And I mean, but basically, I suppose that his skin is in the game too. He has something at stake here, which is, of course, the spice, which is most important, right? And also, what happened to the Spacing Guild preventing these guys from landing? Right, because we were kind of discussing what the Spacing Guild had in mind to prevent these guys from landing, and now the Spacing Guild has just let these two parties onto the ground, and I mean, it mentions that the guild is super desperate, and then they let the Harkonnens and the Imperium to land. So it's really weird, because Paul must have communicated that he holds the spice hostage, right? Because if he didn't communicate that, then the guild would just, you know, let the Harkonnens run amok and just kill everyone, and then, you know, easily the entire universe can overwhelm the Fremen. But since the guild knows that Paul can really destroy the spice at like the snap of finger, then the guild allowing the two most powerful and aggressive parties to land, I don't think sends a good message. But I'm not sure here, right? It just seems really aggressive, but at the same time, passive.
Yeah.
I think at the same time, like, the guild is like doing it because it's like the safest play they can make without involving more parties. So they're kind of like dropping off the Harkonnens and Imperium because they are the two other parties that are involved with the conflict here. Firstly, because Imperium did assign the Atreides to Arrakis, so they have the right to like come and dictate the proper rule of Arrakis. And then obviously their challenger is the Harkonnens. So they're allowing like the two contestants for Arrakis come, and then like the judge, which is like the emperor, come and like decide the final like say. So in a way, the only thing that the guild is doing is like almost providing grounds for negotiation, but not really. You know what I mean? It's like the guise that they're under.
Mm-hmm. And Paul could have communicated with him that it's sort of like a personal matter between him, the Imperium, and the Harkonnen. So he needs to keep everyone else out of it and just let us fight it out, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically. I mean, it's just so annoying that there's just so many, you know, crows just trying to pick like carrion eaters, you know.
Right. Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, there's just so many people trying to get the last pickings out of the carcasses of either Atreides or the Harkonnens, right?
Mm-hmm. They're like little mosquitoes just buzzing around trying to get all the blood.
Carrion birds, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, but we also get a small update on the status of the war. So they've taken down all of the outlying towns and forts. Either they cut him off or they just took him over outright. And now it's really just this basin with Arrakeen that the Harkonnens still have. So Robin must be shaking in his boots right about now, right, along with everyone else, because this is their last stronghold on Arrakis. We have the whole planet except for this place.
Mm-hmm. He's backed up into a corner.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're only protected by the shield wall, which kind of like protects them, but at the same time also cages them, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. It's like a trapped, frightened animal, you know, or a mouse in their hole, you know.
Well, it looks like the Emperor is pretty confident in his ability to win, considering he brought their women, lackeys, and servants. However, I'm not really sure what's behind this crazy confidence, because I'm sure there's got to have been someone who warned him about the dangers of the Fremen people. But right now, it doesn't really look that way. Because, I mean, he seems even less aware of how strong the Fremen are than even the Baron.
I agree, yeah. I really just don't see where the Emperor's confidence is really coming from. Is it because like there are other ships above him carrying like legions more troops from other great houses? Because like either way, these auxiliary troops are inaccessible to the Emperor if the guild won't let them land. So I really wonder like why exactly the Emperor is being so bold as to be on the front lines himself, like because like he's entering the fray as like the main force instead of just like sitting in the rear like hoping for security. Usually like the Imperial, like the crown Emperor, doesn't come to the front lines himself. He would probably just like sit up on the, if I was me, I would be sitting on like a ship or even back at home on the throne watching this through like some TV screen, honestly. So
yeah, it doesn't really make sense for him to show up himself.
Yeah, like
because if he dies, then it's all over.
Positive point that he wanted,
right?
Yeah, like only reason I could think of is like the respect part. I don't know. Also, between the dialogue of like Stilgar, Paul, and Gurney, we kind of get a sense of there's another warrior in the group other than just Gurney himself. Remember like last chapter, a couple of chapters ago, we said that Gurney was a pretty big doubter. He was scared a lot, and that's fine, you know? But it seems that there's another person, Stilgar too. He's kind of a bit of a warrior. He's like warning Paul of all the possibilities of like the Harkonnens Well, they like chose to do this or that, right? But Paul, of course, you know, he, as always, same with Gurney, he kept his composure and always had an answer to all of Stilgar's worries. But then it's like, I get that Paul's extremely perceptive and analytical because it shows his unwavering confidence, you know? And like, he also has like this confidence in himself, in the Fremen, and like in his comrades, right? But I feel like it's almost to such a dangerous extent because as soon as the Imperium, the Sardaukar, or the Harkonnens break even one of his assumptions about them, his plan basically has like a massive gaping hole in it.
Yeah, I mean, Paul, and especially when he's asked about the communications device and how he's trackable, I mean, first it kind of reminded me of today's digital age and how, you know, everything is trackable, right? But you just don't worry about it. And that's kind of what Paul is doing here. He just says, they'll soon be too busy to find me. It's so nonchalant. And I think it's just so cool and collected of, it's such a cool and collected way of dealing with things. I mean, although I hope he's not going to be so cocky in battle, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a calculated move on his part.
Yeah, but also he has to. I mean, he also later says, you know, oh, I wish I felt that confidence I just said or something like that. He's clearly not confident, but as a, you know, any leader would do, he has to project confidence onto his troops.
Make it till you make it.
The bluster.
Yep, he definitely needs that.
Also, another aspect that we get to witness in this chapter is just like not only Paul's leadership, but really like the coexisting roles of Stilgar and Gurney as the right hands of the Duke. So remember from like last chapter, we had disputes about, you know, Stilgar remaining as Paul's right hand side, and then like how Gurney and Stilgar are mixed together now that they're like accepted, right? So now we kind of witnessed their roles in this battle scenario and the strategic planning moment. We kind of witnessed Paul entrusting Stilgar with managing mainly the Fremen troops. Instead of doing it himself, he makes like Stilgar micromanage and like manage all the little messages coming in and summarize it for him. And as for Gurney, Gurney plays more of like a advisor figure, right? He like, he's kind of like the personal guard of like Paul, but at the same time, he's like the person that he talks with, like the politics and all like the strategic planning down to, because at the same time, he is the most well-versed in discussing the geopolitical implications of everyone's singles, like Paul's strategic plans.
I'm really glad that these two have found a way to get along, especially after that whole scene where, you know, Stilgar swears fealty and everything. And it's just nice that they're using their talents together for the benefit of the Fremen instead of, you know, fighting each other or the Fremen kind of being angry that there's two people in this position.
There wasn't really a struggle for power or a struggle for dominance, and instead they just kind of interlock with each other really well.
And it's nice because I think it's just setting a new path for the Fremen, because they're normally savages, right, with kind of this behavior of killing for leadership. But I definitely think it's really nice since Paul's end goal is really to avoid violence, right, because of the jihad and everything. So I think it's just anything he does in that way, it's just a nice like milestone.
Okay, so I actually finally understand why Paul told the Sardaukar that he captured a couple chapters ago that he was the Duke of Atreides. And it looks like he's just using him as bait in order to enact this first attack in the war. And his plan has to do with rocket launchers, which I'm assuming to get a massive hit as their first move. But I'm kind of interested in how this will play out.
Right. To me, it's kind of ironic, honestly, because consider when the Harkonnens first attacked the Atreides all those years ago. They too came in with like this old technology such as artillery and rockets, like weapons that are relics of a supposedly bygone era. And now like Paul here himself is like reversing it upon them, right? Like as usual, like he's using the advantage of the fact that there are no shields on Arrakis, where there's going to be like very little usage of shields as soon as like the sandworms come or like as soon as the storm comes. So he's using the negation of the shields to their maximum advantage, because at the same time, as long as there's no shields, at least in this timeline, they didn't really prepare anything other than shields against projectiles. So rocket and like artillery fire is still as effective as ever in this timeline, as long as there's no shields stopping them.
Yeah, he's pulling a Uno reverse card.
Basically. And like, and just like that quote, and I don't know the exact wording, but you know, why change what works, right? I mean, if it's working, basically, just don't bother changing it.
Oh yeah, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was looking for. And also, you know, just overdoing this first hit a little bit could send a message that they have enough resources to just use them flamboyantly to blow up stuff. You know, it's just, it sends a message, really. Everything is about sending a message.
Dramatic irony.
Yeah. And I know that this scene was hinted at a long time ago. But it feels unreal now that we're here. So there was a scene in one of Paul's visions of the jihad where he saw Gurney again on the battlefield. But now that we're seeing it for real, I realize how far we've come in the story. So thank you guys for sticking with us as we get closer and closer to the end of Dune.
Boy, but it gets closer every week. Yeah, wow. We're like only three, I think we're five episodes away, right?
Around that.
Probably. Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm. But also to add on to the already building excitement, Herbert teases that there's a great-grandmother of a storm coming. And throughout this entire chapter, he continues to emphasize on this coming storm as one of the biggest ever. And I just really love how he only doubles down later with the great-great-great-grandmother of a storm. I think it truly, especially as it builds onto Paul's like career almost, that it's like he's setting the perfect stage for the immortalization of like legends here. Like today, this day will be remembered forever because of all the extraordinary things going on, because Paul is here, because like a massive storm will show up. I'm sure like another massive sandworm will show up. And it's just like all the pieces necessary to make Paul go down in history as like the most successful Lee Sun Al-Gaeb, but like Muad'Dib person ever. He will be remembered. And that's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I wonder. Yeah. I mean, it's just really crazy. It's just, you know, it's Paul is just achieving so much right now.
Yeah.
He's an overachiever.
Yeah.
So apparently they had their hands on some atomics, which I kind of didn't remember, but I sort of remember now that they're mentioning them. But it still feels weird when they mention it because like it's like sort of unexpected that they would ever use atomics, because I mean with the worms and everything, and also they could also use atomics. So you know how in our world it's like mutually assured destruction if someone uses atomic. So I thought it would be like the same here.
Yeah, don't be mad, guys.
Yeah. So I was wondering if the atomic weapons of Dune are much smaller than ours, so that they're easier to move around.
Yeah, I mean, they've probably figured out a way to compact things. Like, I mean, they can travel at interstellar speed, so yeah.
I would hope so.
Yeah. So, I mean, so clearly they found a way to bend reality. I mean,
Well, anyways, it looks like Paul is planning to use them to blow up the shield wall. So I'm not really sure what he plans to do about the radiation, though, because, well, that seems like a pretty big issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess he's not sticking around long enough to figure that out. But yeah, I do remember them like mentioning early on in the world building sections of the book that the great houses did possess atomics. It's just that nobody wanted to use them because, as you said, mad, right? Everyone's scared of the mad. And right now, even though like Paul is basically hoping that he won't directly harm anyone and therefore remain on the good side, whatever like the success of the Geneva Convention is in the Dune world.
Geneva like, suggestions?
I was about to say that.
No, am I bad? Even here, we don't really follow it. And you know, Paul's going to twist the rules a little. He's going to bend it. And he acknowledges that. But like, whatever's going to happen, whatever like atomic he is going to pull off, it's going to be one big shock that's going to need justification when the day is remembered in history. So he's going to be remembered in history for probably winning something, a great battle. But like historians later on will be like, was Paul correct in using the atomic to blow up the shield wall? Just like how we get critiqued like our bombing of Japan nowadays.
Yeah, that's going to be on iSideWith.com in a few years, you know, one of those controversial topics. Just, was Paul correct in using atomics to blow up the shield wall? Like 58% yes, 42% no kind of thing.
Yeah.
But tying on to that, here's my quote for the week, which is a bit interesting, but for some reason I started laughing pretty hard when I saw it. So it goes... Use of atomics against humans shall be cause for planetary obliteration. So I don't know why I found that funny, but I was just like, yeah, you know, let's just obliterate some planets, guys. You know, no big deal. I mean, I think we have the ability to obliterate our own planet, right?
I think around 20 times over or something.
That's just, you know, I don't know why I find that kind of, I guess, morbid humor, right? But I mean, just thinking from Earth perspective, given that the US dropped bombs in Japan and they, you know, used it to target humans, I mean, it would have been cause for a whole planet to be blown up by whoever regulates this interstellar kind of thing, right?
Geneva suggestions.
Yeah. But I also think Paul is kind of pulling his trump card here. And even if he somehow kills humans with this atomic and Arrakis is destroyed, right? Then the spice is gone. And that's kind of what everyone else is going for. So he has a he kind of can force people into, well, not force people, force his enemies into kind of like a lose-lose situation. But I like this convention rule, though, because it shows that there's some regulations, even in this interstellar space, and it's just not some brawl, some free-for-all, right? It's not just like, oh, each planet has its own rules, but between planets, you know, all bets are off. I don't like that. But I like that there's some rules here. It's just, oh, you can't drop nukes on people, otherwise we'll drop a nuke on you, kind of thing.
Right.
An eye for an eye. But I mean, I'm glad there's still a shred of civility left, even though it's so hard to regulate.
Mm-hmm. But what I don't completely understand is like, why didn't they just use a las gun to hit the shield wall from a distance? Because wouldn't that have the same effect as an atomic?
Well, I think they mentioned it later on in a book, but sometimes the Harkonnens didn't turn on their shields until like the Fremen got close. And it's just like they can't depend on that, right? And sometimes
But isn't the shield wall like always the, on?
It can be disabled.
I guess
yeah,
so.
Like when UA betrayed them.
That's true.
Right.
But yeah. UA turned it off. So yeah. I'm assuming that it would be always on if someone doesn't turn it off.
Yeah, but like maybe they would have turned it off here because of because like the incoming storm would have overwhelmed their generators or something. I don't know.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Or maybe the fact that the atomic explosion they used was still going to be smaller than whatever explosion would have resulted from a massive like cliff size.
I'm assuming hitting the shield of the las guns would transfer like a huge amount of energy and that would kind of radiate out, so it could blow up the entire like shield wall, like, you know. But they're just trying to go for like a targeted attack, I guess.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
maybe the atomics in Dune are way different from the atomics in our world.
Yeah, they probably have, you know, made that a lot better. Yeah.
More controlled, yeah.
Right. And there's another nice quote here when Stilgar mentions the untrustworthiness of the city people. Paul just really gets him here. I was once a city man myself. And he's just, you know, you really trap Stilgar there and just kind of shut all his options down. But the quote I liked is, "I know what you meant, Still, but the test of a man isn't what you think he'll do. It's what he actually does. These city people are Fremen blood. It's just that they haven't yet learned how to escape their bondage. We'll teach them." So I like how they're going to give these city people their opportunity to uprise, right? And I really like this lesson. I mean, it's kind of a generic lesson, but like, don't judge a man by his like past actions or by even...
Or
like
actions speak louder than words.
Yeah, actions speak louder than words, but also it's just like... You know, just don't judge him by, you know, things he did in the past. So I think like you have some bias, right? Just like kind of judge them by what they're actually doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it looks like Paul is going to use the city people as shock troops because, well, their hate towards the Harkonnen is fresh. So, I mean, it's smart to weaponize their hate. But I'm not really sure how strong they are because, well, I know that they're definitely not as strong as their counterparts, the Desert Fremen. And seeing as how Gurney said that the slaughter among them will be fearful, they're going to get destroyed. I mean, however, it still looks like they're still willing to take up this role.
Yeah, so this is Coden calculating on pause, and yes. But at the same time, like, he's also not wrong that there is kind of a beauty of redemption to all of this entire mess. So this kind of segues directly into my quote of the week, which is, "You see, gentlemen, they have something to die for. They have discovered their people, their awakening." So it's just like really finally the city people, right? These Fremen who live in the communities, who live so distantly from their brothers in the desert, they finally start seeing themselves as part of a larger sense of being, like a larger group. They start seeing themselves as connected to the same type of people, the Fremen, right? After so many centuries, they're beginning to see themselves as a group with an actual identity, no longer just bystanders in the political rackets. Because before, they didn't care, you know, someone settles in, they just live their everyday lives. But now they're driven to identify as an oppressed people. And when people are oppressed, they tend to unite together and fight for this shared sense of identity because of whatever they're oppressed by, usually skin color or like ethnicity, etc.
Class.
Now this sense of purpose... Or class, yeah, stuff like that. See, like socialism, I mean, communism, like apartheid, etc. There's many examples in history of that. And just like the sense of purpose is really strong. It is dangerous because obviously it could go off on the wrong foot. And like Paul says, the jihad can happen. But it is a tool that Paul must master in these environments. And it's an effective tool. It allows him to push the city Fremen determinedly towards their deaths, but at the same time, it's a fearful tool because as soon as it runs amok, they quickly fulfill the vision of the jihad that Paul so fervently runs away from. And the thing is, to awaken is both a blessing and a curse, because you can awaken into the real world because they can finally change stuff about what is bothering you in your life. But at the same time, to change stuff in the real world, you must also first meet headfirst the pain that comes with living inside the reality. So I'm happy that these Fremen have awakened, but at the same time, it's going to cost them a pretty penny to get out of this mess.
Yeah, I mean, these people have just been oppressed their whole lives by the Harkonnens and various other forces, and Paul is just channeling all of that against their enemy. And I bet that these city people were once distrustful of the Fremen, right? Initially, maybe even, you know, but after getting expelled by the Harkonnens and the Fremen just taking them in, and they're really ready to fight for them. So what the Harkonnens plan of just expelling them just really backfired. They are taking in a lot of refugees, yes, but they're weaponizing them. And that's something the Harkonnens will never see happening. It's just like, yeah, these useless people, just kick them out of their homes. But then, you know, Fremen are giving them a use. And even if it's 10 to 1, like 10 deaths of city people against one Sardaukar, these people are ready to fight for it. You know, they're ready to die for this cause because they know that they're going to die anyway, right? Because of the way they've been treated or their current circumstances. And even if the Fremen lose, then these people are going to get wiped out. So,
they're sort of in a pickle.
Yeah, so it's just basically really motivating to see all these people so rallied up against the Harkonnens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like Paul said, they're basically doing free recruiting for the Fremen. So basically, easy pickings, I guess. And here we actually get a bit of a pause, because now we see that though Paul is like still doing a lot of things, he's managing all these different strategic plans, discussing things over with his generals, Paul at the same time still caught up on one thing. He's still caught up on the fact that the emperor might still recognize the Atreides' claim to Arrakis through the raising of the proper flag, which is the Atreides flag, right? But the thing is, sadly, the emperor disappoints Paul, and instead he raises the flag of the Choem Company. And like, it baffles Stilgar, it still kind of baffles me a little, because I can't quite discern what exactly the emperor wants whenever he displays the Choem Company's flag. Because it's like, does the emperor, like the guild, just want a promise that whoever walks away the victor of this battle will promise them a share in the spice harvested on Arrakis, so it doesn't matter who's actually on top? Or it's just like, do they actually have a favorite side that they're trying to pick from, right? Because like, in that case, why not, again, just stay out of this entire mess and let the Harkonnens fight the Atreides? Because it doesn't matter who wins, because like, either way, as long as you cut the right deal, you'll get the spice that they so longingly seek for.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just like a symbol, raising this flag. It's just saying that they don't care about anything but the profit. I mean, it doesn't really matter who rules this place as long as it's profitable, right? And perhaps maybe the emperor's sending a message that the reason they're here is the spice and nothing else. Or perhaps Choem promised the emperor a cut, so, you know, the emperor's just kind of repping the Choem banner. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, maybe doesn't the emperor own the Choem company?
Does he? I remember something about
a large share of.
Yeah, he owns a large share of it. Oh, but I think it's I heard, you know, I remember reading something about the Choem company, like directorships being some of the most coveted positions or something like that. And the emperor is a large like shareholder, which is kind of funny. Like, you just imagine the Choem company stock going up and down, you know.
Bro, that's such insider trading.
Yeah, that really is.
I mean, you gotta buy now while it's low.
That's true.
Yeah. So, I mean, but I also love how Paul uses these keywords. It's my storm. So he just continues to fan the religious flame in the Fremen, especially before battle. It's really important that everyone's super committed and devoted to the cause. And if Paul can literally and figuratively summon the storm, it does seem like an omen. Right. I mean, it's just, especially in the eyes of the Fremen, like maybe to us, you know, since we're not, you know, super like believing in the supernatural, then, you know, maybe to us it just seems, oh yeah, it's a storm. But to these Fremen who are, you know, see symbols everywhere, they would be like, oh my gosh, you know, it's him. The Lys and Al-Gaib is bringing the storm to wipe out all of the others, all of our enemies. Right. Yeah. And that's just, I mean, that's what they'll see. So it's just more power to Paul here.
Oh, sort of like how Christopher Columbus convinced some of like the ancient tribes that he's going to take out the sun if they don't give us food. And then he So basically, he knew there was going to be an eclipse in a couple of days. And he's just like, oh, if you don't give us food, I'm going to take out the sun. And so the eclipse happened. And so the ancient people got really scared and just gave him a bunch of food.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember which tribe it was.
I never heard that story. But that's
I can't really remember.
Christopher Columbus never landed on the mainland.
No,
was it Columbus or was it?
It might have been
Cortez. It might have been Cortez.
Yeah, it was Cortez. It might have been Cortez.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, Cortez was a brutal conquistador. So,
yeah. Also matched up with the Aztecs' belief in, like, I forgot their god, like the weird Quetzalcoatl thingy, but like basically they believe that it consumed a sun, and that's why like Cortez was like God, I guess.
Yeah, he was like a messenger from God, maybe.
Yeah, especially because they've never seen people of a different skin color, right?
White.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they're wearing armor too.
Yeah, so it just looks
that's
like,
true.
Yeah, they're soldiers from God.
Metallic.
Yeah. Well, moving away from that quick history lesson, it looks like Paul is planning to use the sandstorm as the opening for their attack. And as the storm takes out the shields, they're planning to blast a hole in the shield wall while using the atomic. And so these Sardaukar are in for a rude awakening when the Fremen start charging in through that opening.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I mean, then the responsibility for this attack is set on Gurney. And this is the man who had the inhibition. He was just, you know, oh, well, this violated the Geneva suggestion, you know, kind of guy. But although, I mean, I trust Gurney's loyalty. He seems to be a man of his word. And especially in this situation, he does execute. Even if it's against his against his best judgment, he does execute. So that's something good.
Mm-hmm.
He'll still press the button.
Yeah, he pushed the big red button. You know, never give.
Basically.
Always give Gurney Halleck the nuclear codes. All of our presidents, you know, don't deserve them. Just give Gurney Halleck the nuclear codes for real.
Yeah, he has the briefcase.
But we also see here just like the Fremen's adaptability to taking advantage of situations like sandstorms by playing the comparative here. So the thing is, like, it is true the sandstorm is, you know, neither a great time for either party to attack because there's going to be problems with the sandstorm, right? However, the Fremen are comparatively going to be better off attacking during a sandstorm than the Harkonnens because they know how to handle the situation a little better than the Harkonnens. So while both the Harkonnens and Fremen may have very limited visibility, the Fremen are able to mitigate a lot of the disadvantage by pre-setting the Fremen gunner sights like they did in the book, right?
Mm-hmm.
So things like this allow the Fremen to, in a way, catch a larger, better equipped army off guard because when they drag them down both to the same level of ineffectiveness and they have a little leg up because they know the environment better or like they know how to mitigate a lot of the effects of it, they're able to catch them with their pants down. They're able to catch them defenseless and weak and not expecting it. That's like the greatest strength in a guerrilla army, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I mean, the Fremen have the advantage that they know the land. It's kind of like the Vietnam War where the Vietnamese were fighting the Americans and the Vietnamese really knew their land while the Americans were just stumbling through the marshes, you know, catching disease. And this is really just guerrilla warfare. Yeah, guerrilla warfare at its finest, right, I think.
I mean, they even use Agent Orange.
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
Yeah.
On top of this, though, we actually see Paul using tactics to also confuse the intel of the Imperium. So not only is Paul using physical tactics, he's also basically doing counterintelligence almost. And so in the first sortie encounter from the Imperium, Paul orders the Fremen to use body shields as they face off against the ground cars firing projectiles. Even though we do also know that shields in the desert prove a great risk because they attract, you know, big worm activity because it hurts the worms or something.
Mm-hmm.
So Paul weighed this and decided that it's worth maintaining the image of like using shields as long as they prevent the Imperium's usage of atomics against the Atreides and the usage of lasguns, etc. And who knows, like maybe Paul kind of does hope for the appearance of like a massive worm in the heat of battle because it'd be really cool to just see like a massive like Harkonnen camp swallowed up by like a big gaping mouth. So maybe Paul's hoping for like a double kill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's going to use the worms as backup.
Uh-huh. Man, yeah. the dude is summoning storms and summoning worms, you know, he's just summoning everything. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's like a Disney princess using the animals to his
advantage. Oh no. I mean, he literally is an animal. He is the mouse, so
I mean, true enough.
Yeah, what a comparison. Man, I swear every single protagonist somehow at some point in their career gets compared to a Disney princess.
I mean, they all have magical ability, so I can see
every
how
single
that works.
Protagonist, man, every single one.
Yep. So I thought this line was so interesting that I had to choose it to be my quote for this week. So one said, "A great, great, great grandmother of a storm, Muad'Dib." So I thought it was funny how they referred to the storm as a she when they could have just as easily referred to it as a he. Or I think it's like how we refer to boats and cars in our world as she instead of he, or at least most of the time anyways. And also the way they called it the great, great, great grandmother of a storm gives it a more ominous vibe than great, great, great grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think another reason why they refer to the storm as a female is because of like the protective role it's providing the Fremen. It's kind of like the same reason why we call Earth Mother Nature, or we call like our birthland, like our mother country, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's like the Fremen view the storm as like their mother that will provide opportunity for them, the children, because like it's bringing in, it's like it disciplines them, it brings in opportunities, it's able to do stuff more powerful than they can ever do, right? And for that reason, the Fremen show the storm and like Arrakis a bunch of great love, but at the same time still respectful fear because of the power and for the storm that's gonna come.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like Mother Russia, right?
Mm-hmm. Basically.
It's like, oh, in Mother Russia, you don't ride the worms ride you.
Oh wow. Man, just imagine a sandworm just perched on your back and you're like back breaking trying to carry you across the desert.
It's like they're throwing hooks on you.
Yeah, I was about to say they're just like pulling at your ears with hooks or something, and it's just
it's like leeches.
Yeah, you're just running around in circles. Man, these sandworms are going off. These modern sandworms, dude. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, I just love this description of the storm. I mean, they're using nature against their enemies with the static electricity in the storm blowing out the shields. So that's something I never even considered. You know, I never thought about the storm static electricity. Yeah. I was always thinking about the really fast dust particles and all of that kind of just shredding through metal. But I never thought of this electricity component, right? And I mean, that's why I'm not a meteorologist, guys. But I mean, just imagine the quantity of static generated. That's a huge hazard for sure. It'd electrocute anyone, considering it's grains of sand rubbing together 90 miles an hour. Just imagine how much charge is generated like that. How the electron transfer going on, all of this polarization. And it's just so much charge, right? And what a smart tactic by Paul using all of his resources here, you know, not just, you know, letting the storm shred through the enemy base, but also just wiping out all their defenses along the way. So it's just, you know, just imagine you're just sitting outside with the coffee, with the shield, you know, and suddenly your shield is shredded and then you're shredded, you know, kind of.
Oh my, turns into a massive blender.
Yeah, it really is just a massive blender.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy.
So now, basically, Paul, you know, Gurney presses the button and the shield wall blows up, you know. And I wanted to point out something that I'm not quite sure how I feel about, because Paul was trying to reach the Fremen, like the Fremen observers who were out there at the time, to get them to pull out, you know. But then he was met with static inside the communications equipment because of all the storms going on. However, but the thing is, like, he kind of immediately decided that their lives had to kind of almost be a necessary sacrifice to make it like succeed, right? To make the rest of his battle plans go according to plan. And it kind of saddens me a little bit, because I understand that Paul has to capitalize on the rare opportune moment to win. But at the same time, it saddens me that he pushed the button without ever hearing back from the people that he was trying to like watch out for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, he knows his priorities too, right? I mean, it's just like with all these. Yeah, I mean, it's just he's just using this and capitalizing it on everything, really.
It's almost like that scene where the Fremen like kamikazed into the Harkonnen ship and brought it down.
Oh, I remember that. I mean, that was the first time where we really saw the Fremen's kind of devotion to into the cause. They're so analytical about it, really. They're just, you know, oh yeah, this life is like,
you know.
Yeah, well, if we're trading 1 for 10, the 1 doesn't matter kind of thing. Yeah, I mean.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. Like, that's what I thought about when I read this, because it's just like, oh, like Paul was willing to sacrifice these people mm-hmm. in order to make sure the rest of the plan was able to kill a lot more people.
Uh-huh. So that's just, I think that's just, although it is a little bit, you know, cold-blooded, but it's also, as a leader, you can't be accounting for everybody. Yeah, you just have to account for the good of you have to account for the good of everybody, but you can't account for individuals.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. It's the winner that tells the story,
that's
after
true,
all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But another thing I want to point out was that despite Paul's bravado throughout his entire chapter, we see that he is, in many parts, still careful, even though we just critique Paul for, you know, for something that we... a little cold-hearted. So the men are like clearing out a bit of a blocked passage with lasbeams, but Paul does get upset and demands that it is done with their hands only, because remember, lasbeams cause big explosion when met with shields. And also, when the wind was picking up outside, Paul orders the men to leave their equipment behind and prioritize themselves. So yes, Paul can be cold-blooded and calculating at times, but at the same time, Paul isn't always forthcoming with his language to express his love for the people and for his community, there's still kindness within Paul that guides the commands that he utters, right? Because he's a leader that's not only for his own wants, for like to go back to the Atreides and to get back his birthrights, but he also sees the community's needs as well and is able to protect that at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he knows his priorities. Like, what's a few transmitters when they could lose these really important fighters? And remember, these Fremen are invaluable. They're not just some random hobo you pick off the street, you know. It's just
Normal conscript.
Yeah, not your normal person. These people are people who have been living in the desert. They've been hardened by battle and by trauma and by fear, right? And they're really the cream of the crop in terms of fighters. And you know, each mm-hmm. one is invaluable, because each one could take out 5 Sardaukar, right? So it's just, I mean, certainly worth more than the transmitters. They can build those again. They can't build these people again.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And so we end the chapter on a very sad note. So there has been a raid on Siege Tabor, where Aaliyah and Paul's son are, and it looks like Leto II is dead and Aaliyah has been captured. So, well, I hope this isn't the straw that breaks the camel's back and forces Paul into the jihad, but I feel like this bit is the bit at the ending is perfect for the situation. How little the universe knows about the nature of real cruelty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like so many different ways to view that ending quote. Like, is Paul implying that he knows better than the universe? Or is he being sarcastic to cover up the immense torment welling up inside him right now? Because like, so much is going on. Like, it's unclear whether his family is all alive or dead, but at the same time, Paul feels it. You know, Paul feels there's something wrong, and he thinks that his son is dead right before he goes to a major battle. There's so much riding on the line here, and emotion will cloud any strong leader's judgment, especially when his family just died. So
yeah, so it's really the worst time for him to receive this news, especially when the battle has just begun. He's gonna have to fight through, you know, even when thinking about, you know, like sometimes, I mean, not really comparable, but you know, sometimes you walk out of a room and you had a really bad test, or you had a really bad day or something, and you just can't really function, even though you know you have to maybe have another test that day, or you have something else really important, like, you know, you have some really important presentation or something like that, right? And then you just really can't function through it. Yeah, it's just really hard to push through, you know, the past. And Paul is just going to be permanently stuck in the past here, kind of thinking about his wife, his children, right? And his sister and his mother. So he has so many targets to worry about. But and I mean, I don't know how Paul knows exactly that his son is dead, right? I mean, it's that like present moment prescience kind of thing that we saw last chapter, but
maybe
but he seems rather convinced. I don't think Herbert would write it that with that finality if he's gonna turn the tables on us. Like, yeah, you know, he's just critically injured or something. Yeah, not I don't think that's how.
I mean, there could be a plot twist with Aaliyah, but mm-hmm. we're not really sure.
Maybe,
yeah, but I mean, from what we can tell here and with the way Herbert wrote it, he's gone. So that's just really
probably gone.
Really, really saddening, and definitely for Paul, incredibly demoralizing. And you know, this whole Fremen battle kind of rides on him. So he's gonna be facing the greatest burden of his life. He didn't just lose his father, now he's lost his child, you know, kind of losing in both directions, which is kind of really sad.
Yeah. And it's also really sad because, I mean, we thought it was going to be sort of a one-sided battle where Paul just launches a surprise attack on them and wipes them out. But it looks like they also got the jump on him as well. And the fight becomes a lot more even than we thought.
Yeah, which is weird. I mean, we just don't know I thought it was deep in the south.
Right.
I don't know. Has the guild been spying on them or something? I mean,
was there a traitor?
Yeah, maybe there's a traitor. Who knows? Maybe the Sardaukar told. I don't remember the Sardaukar were ever taken to Siege Tavern. Probably not, right? Risk. But yeah, I mean, these two surprise raids happening at the same time, man, that's just really, really bad. But
it hurts.
But we're going to have to wait until the next chapter to find out what happens and what's the aftermath of all this, because the battle is only starting, but the consequences are already beginning.
Yep.
And on that note, I believe that concludes the discussion for this episode of the Do Not Enter podcast. Make sure to read halfway through chapter 47, ending at "Silence, the Emperor roared." So, man, that's going to be a cliffhanger, right? But and tune in next time when we discuss it. As always, thanks to all of you listeners for being patient with us and being interested in our thoughts. Follow us on Instagram at Do Not Enter, Reddit @DoNotEnter, Twitter at Do Not Enter, and email us at DoNotEnter@gmail.com. That's DUNENOTENTER@gmail.com. Please contact us with questions, feedback, or I dare say, does anyone want to take it?
Shun Records.
Okay. Yeah. Or I dare say Shun Records. Give us a review on iTunes or Spotify. It only take a few seconds of your time. So, of course, you have to make an account. And then after that, navigate to our show and then click the 5-star button, because that's the only one that exists, of course. And leave a nice review or two if you're so inclined. And the reasons for this are twofold. One, it lets our podcast move up the charts so that we can get it out and Dune out to a wide variety of listeners. And two, on a more personal note, it lets us know that we're doing a good job and motivates us to keep creating content for you guys. So if you could do that, that would be very much appreciated. So thank you guys so much. Otherwise, have a great week, and we will see you all back very soon. We're getting ever closer to the end of this book.
Yep. See you guys.
Yep. Bye.